This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks for tuning in. We have two podcasts for you this week featuring our special guest expert, Mr. Peter Schiff. Mr. Schiff is a frequent commentator on economic issues. You've seen him on a number of different television networks. He's also a best-selling author as well as the chair of Schiff Gold. We will be talking to Mr. Schiff momentarily. On the podcast this week, I'm going to consider a couple different topics. On today's podcast, I'll be talking about economic cycles and how the cycles that existed economically in the 1920s and 30s look a lot like the cycles that exist today. And on the second podcast this week, I'll be considering this question: is the Federal Reserve an asset bubble machine? Are the prices of stocks, bonds, and in particular your house, inflated due to Fed policy? I'll be sharing with you not only my opinion, but also give you some resources that might be helpful as well. So you won't want to miss the second podcast this week. Also, a resource available to you is the Investor's Discovery Kit. If you've not yet received your copy, the Investor's Discovery Kit, visit the website investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com, and we'll be glad to send you a free copy of the Investor's Discovery Kit. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Peter Schiff. Peter is a well-known economic commentator. He is a best-selling author, also chairman of Schiff Gold. And, Peter, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back on the program.
Peter, let's talk about the Fed's recent action deciding not to raise interest rates. Did that come as a surprise to you?
No, not at all. I mean, I never believed that they were going to raise interest rates in June. You know, when the year began, most people were divided between whether or not the Fed would raise in March or June. And now they're trying to debate September or December. I still think they're not likely to raise rates at all in 2015. And by 2016, we'll probably be in such a bad economy, maybe recession, that they'll be doing QE4.
You know, Peter, the Fed revised downward their estimates for economic growth, and yet a lot of folks I interview believe that we may be in a recession currently. What's your take?
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, the first quarter was a negative quarter, which means if the second quarter were to turn out negative as well, then we're in a recession. Although, you know, the way the government calculates it with their low assumption of inflation, it's pretty hard to get into a recession nowadays because they assume that inflation doesn't exist. In fact, in the first quarter, they assumed inflation was negative. So they actually added back, they inflated the GDP rather than deflating it, which is what they normally do. So when the government is lying so pervasively about inflation and underestimating it by such a large amount, they can create the illusion that the economy is growing even as it's in recession.
Peter, let's talk about that for a bit. We have talked about how the reporting of the inflation information is manipulated with, you know, hedonic adjustment, substitution, things like that. What would you estimate the actual inflation rate to be?
Well, I don't even know how to estimate it because it would just be a guess, right? Because I don't even have any real data. But I certainly don't think it's zero like the government is claiming. I mean, I look at the things that I buy. And, you know, a lot of things that are billed, you know, where I get a bill, you know, my satellite radio, I have XM satellite. So between last year and the year before, they increased my rate by 7%. I have a pool service that cleans my pool every year. You know, they take care of it in the summer because I'm in Connecticut. Well, I got the bill for this year, and it's 10.5% higher than the bill last year. The service is identical. And I can go on and on. I mean, food prices. I mean, look at the cost of beef. Buy a hamburger, buy a steak, you know, buy some eggs, you know. I mean, prices are going up across the board. I mean, I don't really experience, look at rents. Look at how much rents are going up. I mean, medical bills, insurance, you know, everything is getting more expensive, and the government claims that nothing is more expensive. So obviously, they're not true. It's not true. But I have no idea how high it is. But I think it's quite a bit higher than the official estimates. I'm sure it's at least 3 or 4%, if not more. And if that's the case, we've been in a recession for the entirety of the Obama presidency, which makes a lot of sense to me, considering the collapse in the labor force participation rate, all the people who are no longer working in this economy. It makes sense that we have a smaller economy today than we did when the president was elected.
So, Peter, let's talk about this whole inflation-deflation discussion. I've had guests on the program that insist that because we have such high levels of debt in the private sector and, of course, in the public sector as well, that the overriding economic trend will have to be deflation. And yet, when you look at the Fed's easy money policies, I have other guests that say we can't help but have inflation. Can you kind of help our listeners sort that out?
Yeah, well, I'm actually in both camps. It depends on what you're measuring prices in. If we're going to define deflation as falling prices, right? If you're going to measure prices in terms of gold, then yes, prices for everything are going to come down. You're going to be able to buy a lot more stuff with your gold in the future than you can today. But if you're going to measure prices in terms of dollars, right, the paper dollars that we create out of thin air, then we're going to have rising prices, right? We're not going to have falling prices. The price of everything is going to go up in terms of U.S. currency because we're going to print so much of it. Yes, we have a lot of debt, and that's why the Federal Reserve has to keep interest rates at zero, because if they let interest rates go up, we'd have to default on the debt. So in order to delay the default or, you know, just postpone it indefinitely, they have to keep interest rates at zero or practically zero indefinitely. And the only way they can do that is to create massive inflation. They have to keep on printing money and devaluing the dollar. And so the people who are expecting dollars to gain value are wrong. They just do not understand the dynamic here, and they're preparing themselves for substantial losses if they're, you know, if they're trying to take refuge in U.S. Treasuries or CDs, or if they're stuffing cash under their mattress. They really should be buying gold, you know, because if you think that prices are going to be down, it's only going to be down in gold. So you better hold that. It's not going to be down in dollars.
So, Peter, let's talk about the stock market, because this past week we saw the NASDAQ get back over the 5,000 mark. I think it's been 15 years since it's been there, and on a nominal basis we've seen the Dow increase since 2000 by about 50%. To what extent are these stock prices attributable to the Fed's easy money policies?
Well, I mean, they're a direct consequence of it, and, you know, the same thing was true the last time the NASDAQ got to 5,000 in early 2000. And, you know, in less than 2 years, by November of 2002, the NASDAQ was down to 1,100. I mean, so you had an 80% decline when that bubble popped. So, you know, we're back in that nosebleed territory. And the last time this happened, the last time the Fed's cheap money policies resulted in NASDAQ 5,000, it ended horribly for the people who were invested in the NASDAQ at 5,000. So it's pretty dangerous. But, you know, I think the Fed is acting much more recklessly now than it was back then. And so I think rather than a collapse in the stock market, what I think is more probable is a collapse in the dollar. Right? In order to prevent the stock market from collapsing, they'll sacrifice the dollar. But in terms of gold, I think the NASDAQ could have a bigger decline in the next few years than it did, you know, when it dropped 80% in terms of dollars.
Peter, we've got a little over a minute left in this segment. Explain to the listeners this whole idea of pricing stocks or pricing assets in gold.
Well, it's a way to keep track of the real value. You know, gold is money, right? And you can keep track of things. You know, how many ounces of gold does it take to buy the Dow, rather than, you know, how many dollars do I need to buy the Dow, and then keep track of that. I mean, you know, in 5 years, will you need more gold to buy the Dow, or will you need less? And I think you'll be able to buy the Dow for a lot less gold. You know, if you look at the historic lows in 1929 or 1932, rather, was the bottom, and then again in 1980, right, you could buy the Dow for about an ounce of gold. I mean, we're way above that now. I forget the ratio. It's above 10, it's 12 or something like that. But at the lows in 2009, we got down to around 8. But we were up at 40 or so at the peak in 2000. You know, it was you needed 40 ounces of gold to buy the Dow or something like that. So we've been in a major bear market since then. But I think we're going back down close to 1-to-1. So, you know, in order to buy the Dow with an ounce of gold, you know, gold would have to come up to 18,000, right? Or the Dow would have to go down to 1,200, or the two would have to meet somewhere in the middle, which I think is more probable. Maybe they'll meet at 10,000 at some point. Who knows? Maybe they'll meet it, you know, at a lower price or a higher price. But I do think that you're going to get within, you know, that range somewhere. Maybe it won't go all the way to 1-to-1. Maybe it'll be 2-to-1. You know, But that would still mean a big drop in the price of the Dow, you know, relative to the price of gold.
I will continue my conversation with Mr. Peter Schiff in the next segment. I think many of you, if not maybe most all of you listening to the program today, would agree that human behavior tends to be predictable. Certainly, when you look at the behavior of groups of people in certain situations, we could probably all agree that groups of people faced with the same sets of facts and circumstances tend to behave in similar ways. Well, that's really the premise for the idea of these economic cycles or economic seasons. Now, there are four economic cycles named after the seasons of the year. And in the interest of time today, I'm just going to focus on two of these seasons or two of these cycles. The first is the autumn cycle. The second is the winter cycle. During an autumn cycle, which we believe occurred from 1982 to 2000, you have plentiful money. You've got a massive bull market, rather. You have much speculation. But the most important characteristic to keep in mind of the autumn cycle is that debt levels become very high. In fact, debt levels rise to levels that are unsustainable, and that's the trigger that brings on the winter cycle. During the winter cycle, an economy experiences a crippling credit crisis and money becomes scarce. We've certainly seen some of that already in this winter cycle with the failure of some banks back during the financial crisis and a bailout of other banks that were considered to be too big to fail. You have massive levels of bankruptcy. You have pension funding problems. That was certainly one of the primary causes of the Detroit bankruptcy. Certainly, we believe that we haven't seen the last of those news stories either. And the most important thing to remember is, again, that debt during this winter cycle has to be purged from the system. Well, as this debt is purged from the system, there are economic consequences that are not all that pleasant. There's certainly some evidence that the current winter cycle in which we find ourselves could tend to be worse than the prior winter cycle that we saw during the 1930s. And that all has to do with the levels of debt that exist. I'm going to give you an article that was published on Fox News not long ago that gave these facts. In 1929, when you take a look at the level of U.S. government debt, U.S. government debt was about 20% of the economy. Today, government debt is much higher. In fact, the official U.S. government debt is in excess of $18 trillion, not to mention there are over $100 trillion of unfunded liabilities. Now, what are unfunded liabilities? Well, these are promises that have been made to pay certain benefits. A couple of these big unfunded liabilities might be Social Security and Medicare, just to name a couple. So in 1929, the federal government wasn't broke. Today, the federal government's official debt is more than 100% of the economy. In 1929, about 20% of the economy. Then you look at private sector debt. Forget about government debt for a minute, which certainly is a factor, but if you look purely at private sector debt in 1929, it was about 240% of the economy as measured by gross domestic product or GDP. Simply put, what that means is that for every dollar in economic output in 1929, there was about $2.40 in private sector debt. Today, for every dollar of economic output, there's about $3.60 of private sector debt. Now, here is the bottom line. If there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. And if there's too much debt to be paid, it means that money will disappear from the financial system, causing banking problems like we saw back during the financial crisis. Certainly, we're seeing the approach of that once again in Europe. And the reason for this is that over 95% of today's money is debt. Less than 5% is currency. Well, think about that. If over 95% of money is debt and there's too much debt to be paid, that means the money supply will contract and we will see a deflationary cycle. Well, deflation tends to be painful. Asset prices reset. Real estate prices drop significantly. The stock market declines. And although we haven't seen that yet to a great extent presently, we have seen stock market declines and real estate declines already in this winter cycle, only to see those asset prices recover because of the actions, in my view, of the Federal Reserve. Going back to 1929, in 1929, most of our states were not bankrupt. One county today, we talked about this on the Everything Financial Radio program just a few weeks ago, Cook County, which includes Chicago, now owes over $100 billion in debt. And the largest part of this, unfunded government employee pensions. In 1929, we didn't have 21 million government employees with high salaries, big pensions at retirement, and free health care for life. And yet today, one out of five federal employees earn more than $100,000 per year. In fact, 77,000 federal employees earn more than the governors of their states. I find that statistic to be amazing and alarming at the same time. 77,000 federal employees earn more than the governors of their states. Many employees of government retire at a young age with $100,000 a year pensions for life. At the state and local levels, there are also pension underfunding problems, significant pension underfunding problems. There are nearly $4 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities for state government employees. There's no possible mathematical way to pay these bills moving forward. And the eternal truth is, if there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. In 1929, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid didn't exist. The federal government had no such obligations, threatening to consume the entire federal budget within just a few years. In 1929, there was no federal disability program, and today almost 11 million Americans are on disability. There are more citizens on the disabled rolls than the population of 39 out of 50 of our states. There are more citizens on the disabled rolls than the population of 39 out of 50 of our states. So if there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. What will happen? What will be the consequences? We think one of the consequences will be a major asset pricing reset. I'd invite you to visit the website investingapproach.com. The website is investingapproach.com and request our free investors discovery kit. Included in the discovery kit is the book, New Retirement Rules. That book talks about what strategies you might consider implementing in your situation to protect yourself from these major asset pricing resets that we are forecasting. That concludes our second podcast of the week. Tune in again in just a couple days for the second podcast of the week. Bye.